Hello and welcome to Club Soderbergh, an extensive wander in the wilderness of director Steven Soderbergh's creative imagination / filmography. I'm joined today by Maggie Scott.
Hello.
And Carla Donnelly.
Hello.
And this month we're looking at Bubble from 2005, a largely improvised murder mystery using non-actors, shot on video and distributed on satellite pay TV service HDNet. Then, from 2006, the Kafkaesque The Good German, as in the Soderbergh movie Kafka, not the writer. It's another film noir pastiche set in post-World War II Berlin, with loads of literally shady characters leading Gorgeous George down dark alleys. But I'm going to hand over now to Maggie to introduce Bubble.
I'm very ready to get out of this area.
Why's that?
Because there's nothing here. You know, I'm living in this little apartment with my daughter. She's two. You know, you can't make money in this area. It's just poor. Everything's poor.
Martha and Kyle are colleagues at a doll factory in a town near the Ohio River. They live in a bubble where not much goes on. The boring, unfulfilled lives of disenfranchised Americans, which is a theme that Soderbergh likes to explore. Kyle and Martha have a routine, a quiet, unexciting camaraderie. He's very young, very shy, and lives with his single mum in a trailer house. She's older and lives with her elderly dad, who she has to care for. They sit and they chew their lunch slowly and stare at the walls. Martha a bit more invested in Kyle than he is in her. The cameras and the dialogue do not reveal much of what they're thinking. As characters, they're poor, uneducated, and seem not to have the language to express their desires or inner feelings. As non-actors, they are perhaps unable to express with subtlety, but they are nonetheless mesmerising and utterly convincing. Then Rose starts working at the doll factory. In the context of this milieu, she is a bit of a doll face, and also she knows how to airbrush a doll's face. As the only young people, she and Kyle check each other out, and Martha notices. Martha is hard to read, but she must be a little bit threatened by Rose's mad doll face skills. Nonetheless, she is kind to Rose, who is a single mother who asks her for money and babysitting favours. But she discovers Rose is also a thief and somewhat of a spoiled child, using her provincial charm to manipulate every situation to go her way. Martha babysits Rose's daughter, and she goes on a pretty average date with Kyle. When Rose returns, her ex comes around and they have a raucous and immature fight. After he leaves, Martha asks Rose if that was the father of her child, and Rose snaps at her. The next morning, Rose is found dead on her lounge room carpet. It's not an edge-of-your-seat murder mystery. Martha is marked early on in the film as the killer. And you can tell this from a beautiful scene in the church following Martha sitting amongst the congregation, drowned in darkness and then tinted with a blue light, the camera revealing her sitting alone, isolated from everything, her piercing, unreadable blue eyes like that of a doll. We see a similar visual when she's been imprisoned for the murder. What lies beneath? She doesn't even know. She's blank. Mm. A doll factory is spun gold for any filmmaker, but I wasn't sure if the metaphor was right for this film at first, but then as I thought more about it, creepy dolls with their unreadable blank eyes and weird bubbling plastic skin are really the perfect double for the unreadable woman with the most boring life on the planet who is bubbling with rage underneath. Mm-hmm. That she can't even articulate. Rose upsets her boring life and she just loses her shit. I really hope her life in prison is much more exciting in a sort of orange is the new black way. What do you guys think about the doll factory metaphor in this film?
I didn't really think about it too deeply, but hearing you talk about it, I think that it could have been quite clumsy, but I think it is actually a beautifully executed metaphor in terms of a doll for a child is the projection of their dreams and their fantasies or something to play with, but something that is separate from their lives. You know, it is not reality. It's make-believe, it's projection. So I thought that these, you know, very kind of beige, uninteresting people creating these objects for other people to have more interesting lives with, I thought was quite fascinating.
I really didn't get the metaphor at all. I have to admit, I didn't. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I mean, I wonder whether it was just a cool setting that he was able to use.
Sure. That's what I was thinking too. It, you like know? Irresistible, really. Like,
yeah,
yeah, because it was fucking creepy.
Yeah,
like it was. They just made me want to vom the whole time they came on the screen.
Yeah, when he's like peeling the plastic heads out of the molds and stuff, it's really weird. Yeah, I feel like it gave the whole film a slight sense of unease, and I think you're right, it sort of does mirror the sort of implacable facade of Martha, but beyond that I didn't see it as a very profound metaphor, more just as a kind of interesting backdrop or texture, you know, a bit of tone, but yeah.
I think they started out with the screenplay just any kind of factory and assembly line, just to kind of, you know, illustrate how boring and monotonous their lives are.
But then, so then I guess this setting is actually quite interesting because they're not working at like a soup factory or whatever. It's, there's also like dismembered baby doll body parts everywhere.
Yeah.
And kind of just, yeah, that real, I think it adds a real tragedy, or just, it just really elevates the sense of boredom and nothingness that is there. Like, you know, even the really boring job that they do is going to be packaged and shipped to somebody else to enjoy.
Mm.
You know, like they will never have any joy there. That, you know, yeah.
Yeah, that's very much, that comes through strongly in the film, this idea of lives being displaced, that, you know, everything's sort of for, you know, they're just there to get some money and not even enough money to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that happen, the products that they're making happen to other people.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
And I was just thinking that, you know, this is a preoccupation, or, you know, it's a theme that comes up a lot, you know, the boring average lives of Americans, you know, you kind of get it in the underneath.
Mm.
And
in Sex, Lies and Videotape.
I thought this was very Sex, Lies and Videotape. I think it had the same sort of beat, had the same guitar kind of score. It had the same beat in terms of the editing and the framing.
Just not sexy people.
Just not, like the inverse of that storyline. But the same level of desire or passion or what happens when there, it's really the repression. It's about repression.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a lot of what of these sort of working class stories that he tells. And I can't stop thinking about Trump's America when I, because I feel like this is his insight that he has. Like, you know, even though he was obviously, you know, quite middle class growing up, he still grew up in the South, but I think he really understands the absolute destitution, both spiritual and intellectual and financial, of these people.
Mm. And that's all connected, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that I watch this film and I think, yeah, all of these people would vote for Trump because they see someone like them in that kind of, like, almost in a physical way. And then also, like, someone like him would give them hope. He would give them some kind of razzle to their, that doesn't seem entirely out of reach, rather than sort of the lofty ambitions of the left, which is about, you know, feeding poor people in Africa, or, you know, saving the planet, environmental issues. Do you know what I mean? These people are just struggling to eat, you know.
Or they're eating, you know, fast food and not even really noticing what they're eating. Like, food has no pleasure, nothing. Even, you know, her skills as a doll maker, she gets no pleasure out of that, really. Yeah. And I find it interesting with Martha. I think she was amazing, that actor.
Like, incredible.
And she, I find it interesting that she has this bubbling rage that causes her to, you know, hate this girl who's disrupted her life, and yet her life is so boring. Sort of this misguided rage, you know, and yeah.
I think also, just like on a basic level, I think he thinks that, you know, he's reflecting the reality of so many Americans' lives. Like, why shouldn't drama be set in this setting, you know? And I think that, that just on a basic level, he's just interested in kind of representing reality.
And honestly, this is how murder happens.
Like,
this is the banality of murder. You know, this isn't like movie murder of like, you stole $1 million from me, or I'm gonna, like, although of course a lot of murder happens to women at the hands of their partners or ex-partners, and they are crimes of, you know, great passion violence.
Or, yeah.
The majority of crime is committed by people like this, you know, and violent crime. Yeah. You know, they are just normal people who
snap, you know, make a bad.
Who have a moment.
Yeah.
You literally just have a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It really reminded me, actually, a couple of films that it reminded me of. Have you guys seen Bernie by Richard Linklater?
No.
It's from 2011. Mm,
yeah, that's great.
Such a great film. Yeah. It's basically like a really similar storyline. It's kind of this, you know, really unlikely murderer and, you know, who you quite sympathize with.
Jack Black.
Yeah. And a bit of an unreliable narrator as well. So, but it's just a lot. It's not done in this kind of realistic style. It's a lot more kind of staged. But yeah, and also the other thing it reminded me of was Love Serenade, which mm-hmm. is a Shirley Barrett film, Australian film from 1996. But that, you know, just
a lot more comical. Yeah, Love Serenade.
But yeah, yeah, had a bit of the same kind of like small town, you
know,
tedium. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a little bit of the quirk as well.
Yeah.
Ken
Sherry comes and disrupts.
Yeah, the love triangle, the weird love triangle aspect.
Have you seen that, Carla? You have to see it.
Oh, it's amazing. It's so good.
I think this also had that Western aspect of, you know, the stranger comes to town.
Yeah.
And changes the way things are forever.
Yeah.
For the worse, usually.
Yeah.
I didn't know that these people were unknown actors. Obviously, they weren't known to me, but I didn't know that part of it.
They're just locals. They weren't even actors.
That just blows my mind because this movie, I think technically, is one of the best he's made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was so
perfectly paced.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Crisp.
Yeah.
Really crisp. And although
it's only 82 minutes long. Like, yeah. It's so short.
And although there wasn't that murder mystery tension, I was devastated when she finally realized she had done it. You know, and that is her level of denial.
Mm.
You know, that is her safe place. Like, she's in such a level of denial on a daily basis just to survive, just to get out of bed and go to work every day, that she still even couldn't believe that she had done it because she had this fantasy of herself as a good person. I found this movie, I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I found it devastating. I do find it of the time as well. And Jesse, I know you'll probably want to talk about this, is that it really, 2005, sort of height of mumblecore genre. But I also think in terms of what you've said in the past, I think this is more his Dogma 95 film, although there is a soundtrack over the top.
Well,
I think
just
it's kind
a few,
of that naturalism.
There's a few musical motifs, but I don't think it actually interrupts a lot of most of the dialogue or anything. Like, it's very key moments, a bit like Sex, Lies and Videotape.
The naturalism was extraordinary, and it's just magic because
it's beautifully
you
shot as well.
You just can't create that. So it was just one of those beautiful moments of all of these elements coming together to create this thing. Did you like the film, Maggie?
I loved it. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a very quiet little film, so it's not like doesn't sort of blow your head off, but it is beautifully constructed. It's, you know, amazing to look at, even though the shots are very still and, you know, there's not much movement, but the, you know, it's so beautifully, the editing is incredible. The actors are, you know, amazing and mesmerizing, even though they're non-professional. I think they've managed to work with that so well.
I think what I really noticed about the performances is that they're not really performances, or they don't feel like performances, because I think that you don't feel as directed in what you're supposed to think or feel about them and what they're saying in any moment. Like, I think most actorly performances are, you know, they're usually some kind of construction. They're usually consciously trying to set up themselves, the character, some kind of representation of an idea, or, you know, and this just, that's absent, and that makes them so much more enigmatic and interesting, you know, and sort of, you know, it's more like a parable or something rather than, you know, a typical screen narrative, I guess.
Do you want to talk about how it was released? Like, I know that you've thought about this a little bit.
I think it's kind of interesting that he was so ahead of the curve with video, and it was released through HDNet. He cut a deal with HDNet, which is like a satellite cable television company in America that had a movie channel, HDNet Movies, And so it was released in theatres, but it was also released on HDNet at the same time, and then very shortly afterwards released as a DVD. Mm. And I think, yeah, it's something that it was quite controversial at the time. A lot of cinemas wouldn't screen it, sort of like protested.
As in because it was, they were being competed against by the other release models, yeah.
Yeah, but really what he was recognising was that like a film is small and quiet and kind of, spectacular as this, you know, is not, to just rely on one form of distribution is really cutting yourself off at the knees. Mm-hmm. And he really embraced that whole digital world like so much sooner than anyone else, you know, probably too soon in a way.
Fearless.
Well, not too soon because now he's completely magical at shooting in digital.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, like in terms of formalism.
I didn't even realise that because it looks beautiful.
Yeah. It is beautiful, yeah. Yeah.
I don't have anything else. I had my socks knocked off by this film.
I think everyone should watch it.
I had no idea about it. I knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm. I was actually reluctant to watch it. In fact, I should tell you guys this.
I
watched the whole thing without subtitles because I couldn't get subtitles on the DVD I had. And I'm deaf, so I need subtitles a lot. And I didn't catch a lot of the dialogue, but it still made perfect sense to me visually. You know, that says a lot.
Yeah.
You know, a lot
and I think it was incredibly satisfying and solid. And I think, like Bernie, it's going to stay with me for a long time, even though it doesn't kind of, you know, it doesn't have this huge impact. It's a low impact film, but I think it will linger.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, shall we move on?
Mm-hmm.
You can say what you want about the war. Certainly, I would never wish for all those millions of people to die. But the war was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because when you have money, then, for the first time in your life, you understand it. What money does for you. Where before, all you understood was not having it. Money allows you to be who you truly are.
Okay, in The Good German, George Clooney plays an American journo embedded with the military in post-war Berlin, a city in ruins, and in the process of being carved up by Russia and the US as they move ineluctably into their separate corners in anticipation of the coming Cold War. Cate Blanchett plays the Ingrid Bergman-esque Lena, an ambiguous character whose motives and morals remain vague throughout the film, or at least until the very end. And Tobey Maguire is an obnoxious American GI who is trying to play the system but ends up being played by it. The movie plays with themes of moral relativism, America's political role in the world and their own self-image, in quite similar ways to other wartime films The Quiet American and The Third Man, by which it's heavily aesthetically influenced. And like his second film Kafka, Soderbergh goes to town paying homage to filmmaking techniques and styles of the past. An aspect for which the film was heavily criticised at the time, actually, for being kind of an empty, soulless pastiche, or a pet art project and a film school pose, as the New York Times and Guardian pitilessly referred to it in their reviews. I tend to think, however, that it's a good example of a film that has aged well, or at least maybe better than expected. Although it's definitely cool in tone, I didn't find it soulless, perhaps a little mawkish at times in its slavish devotion to period style. I mostly really enjoyed it as both a story and a moral fable, perhaps until the very Law and Order SVU twist ending. My question is more, did this story really need to be told at that time and in this specific way? What do you guys think?
I think no, ever, forever. Why? Why make another World War II film apart from it to be, as is described, as a pet art project? For him to have, this just felt like him to have a World War II film under his belt. I mean, I'll talk a bit more in detail. I'm not dismissing the film at all, but it just felt an exercise in that, like, oh, I need to have one of those.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm reluctant to read anything about World War II or Holocaust. I've read a lot about that stuff and I'm always reluctant to watch anything. It's not the thing I want to go and watch, so it took me a while to kind of watch this and I didn't enjoy it. I understand it's skillful, it's so skillful, the characters are interesting, but I think there's something seriously wrong with the way the story was told. Or maybe the tone, like the tone was so flippant and kind of, I mean, I understand why it is, because he's disrupting a sense of, you know, authenticity and realism that is often used for these kind of films, especially something like Schindler's List that was like so authentic and so, you know, real, and it's not. I mean, every construction of history is a construction and not really the past, and it's a story of the past. So I don't know what he was trying to really say with this. I mean, I think maybe the most interesting thing for me was, again, the relationship between the men and the woman and the way that they project so much onto her. And, you know, that's something that we saw in Solaris as well.
Yeah.
A very similar thing, you know, like where, you know, they're just projecting all this stuff on her and she is who she is, and they're just, they don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree with you 100%, Maggie. It felt very schlock noir-y to me, this film, and the tone I just didn't think was appropriate for the setting. Like it was kind of juxtaposed to me in not in a good way. I really loved Clooney in this, however. Like, I was thinking about my comments about his facial expressions being ungenerous about Solaris, but really, like, where he excels is dialogue, really dialogue-driven projects, and he has such a great way of moving and speaking that this was a really good role for him, and I thought that he really carried it off. Tobey Maguire was fucking fantastic.
Amazing. Like,
he was creepy.
I wanted to drown him in the river,
I know,
too.
Me too. No, I was so happy when he died.
He made me genuinely
angry. Yeah.
I'm like, what a prick.
Yeah. So, like, the whole concept of this film is that it's a 1950s studio film shot in the way a 1950s studio film would be shot, with absolute period authenticity to the most ridiculous degree, but uncensored. So the idea is that the characters, the dialogue, everything is much more realistic to how characters actually would have been. And I think the Tobey Maguire character is an amazing example of that, that he's not just kind of like a, you know, a larrikin or some kind of like, you know, sarcastic, you know, American GI. He's actually a fucking scumbag.
Yeah.
Like, and you do cheer when he dies.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
when he shows
up
dead, it's like, yes!
I just wish he'd had a more grisly ending.
Yeah.
And he was so well cast because he's got this little boy face and big white eyes
his
and
doll eyes.
Very pure face and then this weak little voice and, you know, just a revolting person.
There's a bit, so there's like a bit to unpack from what you said, Mag, but I think in terms of like the kind of, you know, period look of the film, it made me think of Kafka, obviously. And also there was a film just that was recently released by Pablo Larraine called Neruda. It was about Pablo Neruda. And both were done in this kind of, you know, kind of very authentic historical style of filmmaking. But I think what I liked about Kafka and what I liked about Neruda is that they had these like elements of magical realism. They took it somewhere else so that it didn't feel like you were just watching a recreation, which I feel like in parts of this film didn't feel like they belonged to the film, you know, and I think that's a bit jarring. Or even in The Limey, you know, there's like you get a sense in The Limey that Soderbergh's in dialogue with film history, but in this he's just recreating
just derivative
moments.
And yes.
I think as well, like maybe taking way too much joy in recreating the history. You can tell, like, you know, he's loving it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's a lot
so
of pleasure in it.
Where Kate Blanchett turned around to the camera and the lighting was just like perfectly angled, you know, in a ribbon across her eyes, you know, but every single shot wasn't like that. So that made me like be like, all right, be all in or all out. You know what I mean? Like you can't. Yeah. Anyway.
I also, one of my notes was it sort of picks up on his repeated theme of shit men.
Yeah.
Because obviously the Tobey Maguire character, but also George Clooney to an extent, like what you're talking about, Maggie, that, you know, he thinks he's trying to do something. He's on this
noble
and he's completely being driven by lust and, you know, like.
And missing the point entirely.
Missing the point entirely,
And you have no sense of their relationship. She's just like, who's this creep?
She couldn't give a fuck about him.
No, she couldn't.
And she was the love of his life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And he has no idea.
But the thing is that she kept telling him. Like, yeah. She kept telling him no unequivocal terms. It's like, I don't give a fuck about you. You know, I love my husband. I've done everything for my husband.
Yeah.
You know, like, you are incidental to my life.
Yeah.
You know, and you were something that I had to do to get by. Like,
again, such an interesting Soderbergh.
What's a stringer,
to reveal
by the
that,
way?
You know?
Oh, a stringer. I don't know. I didn't know that.
I never looked that up. Sorry, Jess, to interrupt.
She was like a journalist. She was basically like a spy.
Maybe
an
informant.
A plant, yeah.
Right, okay. Because that was something that kept coming up, you know. No, she wasn't my secretary. She was my stringer.
Oh, my God.
So the other thing that was weird, I really actually really loved her character. I thought she was fascinating. She chewed up the scenery. Like, Cate Blanchett was really vamping it up and kind of, you know, brought a lot of depth to what could otherwise be like just a carbon copy of Ingrid Bergman's character in Casablanca. But I found the ending really weird and cheesy, like a high production SVU where, like, it turns out the lesbian grandma who takes in orphans is actually a pedophile, you know, that kind of idea that, like, that this story that, yeah, like, yes, we know that there were Jewish people during the Holocaust who dobbed other Jewish people in. We know that there were collaborators, but that's like, you know, that's the exception that doesn't prove the rule. Like, millions more were murdered by the Nazis than collaborated with them. Mm. So I wonder, like, why he thought that was a good story to tell, why he thought he was the right person to tell that story.
And why that was such a jaw-dropping pivot as
So it was so exposition-y. I mean, that was another thing about the screenplay, I think, in this was very weak. I think he wrote a lot of it, and it was quite weak because there's so much exposition. There's a lot of, like, talky-talky telling you what's going on.
But are we?
Yeah.
Are we really? Raised eyebrow.
Yeah.
You know. So. I think we're a little bit over this kind of twist and turn after two Oceans films as well.
Yeah.
We're a bit like, whatever, mate. You know.
To me, it would have been...
Spell it out. You're not good at a twist ending.
Enough that the businessman's junket.
Yeah, I really would have liked if something really weird happened at the end of this film, like if she turned out to be an alien or, you know, like just something really out there would have really saved this film for me because I enjoyed a lot of it and I enjoyed the disruption to period, like period authenticity, but... it kind of fell in at the last hurdle for me.
I really liked it. I mean, I feel about this film like I think people who like French New Wave like French New Wave. I hate French New Wave, by the way, but I feel like this is that movie for me where I loved looking at it, but I didn't want to think too deeply about it.
Mm.
Do you want to – I try to bring in Australian and Australians – and Australia in every episode if we can. So I love Our Kate, of course. I think this is our first film, Soderbergh film, with a Australian star. But also Jack Thompson.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Which took me a second.
Yeah.
You know, which was really cool. I really liked that.
Yeah, me too. I was like, what? Who is that? Our Jack,
yeah.
Kind of weirdly cast, I have to say, though.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was entirely successful cameo for him, but...
As a pair of films, I think this is a great year for him. I think they're two very bookended extremes of production.
So different.
So different.
Yeah. One so trying to be quite realistic or, you know,
and
trying
succeeding.
To affect realism and the other one completely disrupting realism and making you remember that you're watching a film every second of the way through it.
Yeah. But the thing that I came away from the Good German in particular was, you know, I just really admire his unselfconsciousness.
Mm.
You know, like he just wants to give it a go. He wants to give everything a go. And he's
not scared of failure.
He's not scared of failure. He's not scared of doing something if it's not entirely right.
Mm-hmm.
He'd rather just, and I mean, that can be a failing in some ways as well, but he just wants to get his hands dirty.
Yeah.
And he tries his best to do the best product of the tools that he has during that time. Some of his films, I think, were underbaked in pre-production and probably could have benefited from a year.
Mm.
But at the same time, it seems like he has this real agile, iterative way of making, and he doesn't care that he has this history behind him. He's not constructing his legacy. That's what I really love about him.
I have a good quote here from interviews with Steven Soderbergh. He says, "The three protagonists in The Good German see only what they want to see. They are so obsessive and their environment is so malleable They have, for a moment, the illusion of controlling it, but they are doomed from the start. It is a frustration I feel myself strongly in life, the frustration that all is not as I would like to be. Making movies is a great outlet for the desire for control.
Yeah.
Puppet master.
Yeah. All right, so unless anyone has any other comments, I think we can move on.
Press pause.
Okay, so who's got some tidbits for press pause on Bubble or The Good German?
For Bubble, I do. I probably could have brought this up in the conversation, but originally Martha, which it does actually change the narrative quite a bit, or what we interpreted. Martha was, there was a scene that was deleted, or a couple of scenes that were deleted, showing her getting a CAT scan and having a big tumour.
Oh.
And, you know, that her actions were because of this tumour, which apparently makes you behave in ways that you never would normally. Mm. So that kind of changes my interpretation of her bubbling rage.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
I really like that. I really like that got cut.
Yeah, I do
like
too.
The restraint of it, that we don't have to over-explain this. Mm-hmm.
Especially when it's 82 minutes as well.
Yeah.
You know, like still having, you know, still trimming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, so the only thing I had for Bubble was that looking on the Wikipedia page, I was looking up HDNet. I wanted to see if HDNet still exists, and it does, which is quite amazing because, like, who really has a need for a satellite cable movie network anymore in this day and age? But it's still kicking.
Old wogs, man.
Yeah.
It's quite good. Go around Greece, go around Italy, go around Malta. Everyone's still got their satellite.
Go around Coburg.
Yeah.
So it's still around. And then I found out that Mark Cuban owns HDNet. Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks NBA team.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found that amusing because he was recently in a controversy with Golden State Warrior player Draymond Green about the use of the term owners in basketball teams. So Draymond Green kind of made this statement that he found it a little distasteful in this day and age.
Why? Because there's so many black people in basketball.
And so many white owners.
Mm. Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And Mark Cuban was a bit of a jerk and kind of implied that, you know, he was uneducated about these things. And Draymond Green then gave a speech at Harvard elaborating on his opinion, responding to Cuban's comments in a very eloquent and powerful fashion. You might say he owned him. Really, that's for...
Jesse's really into basketball. Just so
and managed to weave it into our Soderbergh podcast.
That was 100% for my partner, Blair.
Hi, Blair.
Yeah, and anything on The Good German?
Nothing for me.
Nothing for me, though.
Well, I have quite a long, nerdy, self-indulgent one, if you'll permit me. So I thought it was interesting. I did a little bit of reading on the background of the production, like the actual production of the film, and I thought it gives some – I thought it was weird that at this point Soderbergh becomes obsessed with digital and how it allows him total flexibility and speed, and at the same time he's making this film that's the total opposite, using obsolete and probably incredibly painful technologies that allow minimum flexibility. But there was a piece in the New York Times from that period by Dave Kerr, and he says, there's a single word that sums up the difference between filmmaking at the middle of the 20th century and that of today. It's coverage. Derived from television, it refers to the increasingly common practice of using multiple cameras for a scene and having the actors run through complete sequences in a few different registers. The lighting tends to be bright and diffused without shadows, which makes it easier for the different cameras to capture matching images. The advantage for directors is they no longer need to make hard and fast decisions about where the camera will go or how the performances will be pitched. The idea to pump as much coverage as possible into the editing room, where final decisions about what goes where will be made. The danger for a director is that with so much material available, the original vision may be drowned or never really defined.
Mm-hmm.
So during the studio era, it was more typical for directors to arrive on the set, block out their shots, light them with stand-ins, and then the actors would be summoned to come in from their dressing rooms after a brief rehearsal, do their lines, and then go, basically, and then break down and make up the next setup. Mm. That kind of staging is a lost art, Mr. Soderbergh said, which is too bad. The reason they no longer work that way is because it means making choices, real choices, and sticking to them. It means shooting things in a way that basically only cut together in one order. That's not what people do now. They want all the options they can get in the editing room. While the editing process now routinely takes months, I had a pretty polished cut of The Good German 2 days after we wrapped, Mr. Soderbergh said. It was shot to go together very, very specifically. Mm. So I thought that was just interesting to give a bit of background, like as to why he did this and what might have fascinated him about this particular approach to filmmaking.
Because and why it seems so affected.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was a puzzle. That's it was right. literally a puzzle that had pieces to be put together in a specific order. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
And it's actually not in opposition to his fascination with digital. It kind of like not. Connects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's covering, you know, like he's going through every decade of filmmaking and learning it.
Yeah.
It's part of his education.
True. Well, that's exactly right. And I think as a master editor, as he is, you know, and this is what has enabled his upward mobility is that he can write to shoot and shoot to edit. You know, so this is obviously his, you know, a huge educational portion, understanding that. I do have one related to The Good German. So if you like Cate Blanchett in this film, I would highly recommend, I don't know how you can, but it's probably online. Julian Rosenfeld is a German artist who used Cate Blanchett recently in the last couple of years for this short film project called Manifesto. And it's, I think, about 11 or 12 short films, not necessarily sequential, but it's Kate playing, you know, 12 different characters, all very vastly different characters. And I think it's really interesting to see how far she's come from this film. I mean, she was excellent in this film, but Manifesto is absolutely extraordinary, the performance that she gives for all of these characters. So I'd highly recommend that.
Agree. Fantastic.
If we don't have anything else on the films, I'd like to just talk about briefly that Soderbergh has made a statement about Weinstein.
Sure.
So I think it's probably just best if I read it out. And this is in Wired.com. So he says, obviously, a lot of people approached me to talk about it, but my attitude right now is that the voices that matter the most are the victims, and I prefer that we not muddy the water yet. Let the people talk who are the targets. I see a lot of people weighing in, and I don't really care to see them weigh in. I don't know how anybody now thinks that they can get away with this kind of behavior. Now that people who are the targets of this kind of behavior feel they can speak, I think it's game over for that shit. And I'm sorry it took so long. I was just lucky that I wasn't raised in an environment where this kind of behavior was indulged in or viewed as acceptable. The people who mentored me didn't behave like this. When people are like, how can this have been going on? You have to understand everybody creates the version of the entertainment industry that they want to be a part of. I tried and have always tried to avoid people who were known to be toxic. In this instance, I do think there weren't as many people as you think who had a real understanding of the breadth and the depth of what was going on. I didn't. You can find yourself in that territory, especially if you're someone like me who has absolutely no interest in the social aspects of the entertainment industry. I don't go out. All I do is work on stuff. It's been really interesting to see all of that energy that's been built up over all of these years reassembled, channeled, and focused on a person, and yet to see how powerful that is. The energy that's generated from those kinds of encounters in my mind doesn't just disappear. It's out there, and it's in the people it happened to. And to watch it reassemble and fire on one person has been kind of incredible. Buried within most tragedies are opportunities for transcendence. I'm hoping this is one of those situations. I think everybody feels upset that it took this long and it took this much. Nobody feels good about any of it, but I think it's going to be different.
What I find interesting about that is that he says, I don't want to weigh in on this, and then he goes and weighs in on it and makes sure to say that he had nothing to do with it. I kind of wish he'd just said that, let the people speak for themselves and then just shut up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's a good statement. I just think, you know, that kind of hands up. I had nothing to do with this. I didn't know any of it was going on. I believe him, but
at the same time. He did wait a long time before making the statement, though.
Pardon?
He did wait a long time before making a statement. So he's obviously thought about it, and it's not like, it's not a panicked statement.
And given it some time, because obviously, like, he does interviews, like, it feels like every day.
Yeah.
So he's waited to say something. And I agree, like, yeah, I'm not going to say anything, but here's my unofficial statement. But I think it sounds to me like everybody knew, but also at the same time, he's like, I've just surrounded myself. He's also been fairly independent from the beginning. He's had that luxury. So, I believe him when he says that, you know, like, he's just had his own circle of people and he's just done what he is interested in and he doesn't, you know, associate with people like that. I think everybody has a bit of blood on their hands with this. Yeah. But I don't know. The statement is what it is. And
he's not involved. He's not, you know.
He was powerful enough from the beginning to not have to deal with these kinds of things if he didn't want to. So I really believe that statement. And he does seem like a pretty straight up person. So I believe that he's probably, and I think that's why he attracts so many good quality actors to come and work for him for no money, you know, because he is really respectful and he does let them, you know, just be talent rather than play head games with them or anything like that.
No, I thought it was, I didn't have a problem with the statement. I was glad to hear it. I was glad that he did say something. Like, I felt like, even though he says, you know, we should, this should be space for the victims' voices. Like, I agree with that. But at the same time, I feel kind of like, I felt like I wanted to hear him say something.
Mm. I actually want to hear everybody say something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want people to stop talking about it. I don't want it to be buried. And I want this very systematic and widespread acknowledgement of knowledge.
Mm. Yep.
That's why I was so upset. Like, so many people have fallen in my eyes through this whole thing. But that interview, I don't know if you saw an interview with Alec Baldwin, because Rose McGowan, you know, absolutely was raped by Weinstein. And Alec Baldwin was, you know, there's a video clip that she posted about him going on the record not very long ago saying, he's like, yeah, we all knew. He's like, I don't know. It's like, I don't know, you know, but Rose, we all knew that Rose took a $1 million settlement for, you know, being raped by Weinstein. He's like, but I don't really know what that does for victims, you know, like.
Yeah, that was a massively ignorant statement, wasn't
it? So disgusting. But the thing that he doesn't understand when he said that is, like, he literally said, we all knew that Rose McGowan was raped by Weinstein and took a $1 million settlement.
Mm.
You know, like, there's no even acknowledgement of that. Statement.
Yeah.
You know, he just like jumps straight into, you know, like, well, I think she did herself a disservice by taking a settlement.
I think that's what this whole thing has shifted, is that idea that, like, basically when a woman is sexually assaulted, 100% of the time in the past, the blowback was on her.
Yeah.
You know, and what this has shifted is saying that, you know, NDAs are bullshit, you know, in these instances, and they shouldn't be allowed, and all they do is protect men.
Mm. Yeah.
And also at this point now, it's hopefully going to change the culture so women don't have to sleep with men or have to put themselves in those situations to get anywhere in their career.
There was a really interesting...
Like, that's the main, you know,
Yeah, Culture Gab Fest did a really interesting special where one of the women presenters interviewed three women who had had incidents with Harvey Weinstein, and someone raised a really, really important point that, you know, in her situation, she was able to get out unscathed. You know, nothing happened to her. But she said, what I understand is, and what I know and what makes me feel terrible for a lot of these women, is that a lot of women had to go through with it to save themselves.
Yeah.
Out of fear. You know, the only way they could get out of the room safely was to do the thing he wanted them to do.
Yeah.
You know, and that just adds this whole other complication for a victim of feeling like, you know, that they did consent or that they have something to be ashamed of you know. And also, you know, like, it's a way of other people to cast aspersions on their testimony, you know. That's why NDAs happen, because it's so hard for women to get these stories through the courts. Like, yeah.
So I want to end this positively because the New York Times, I can't remember who the writer was, but there was a writer in the New York Times who wrote an article about Annabella Sciorra. So there's... there's now this kind of, people are starting to understand the far-reaching complications and implications of things like this that happen. And he was just like, I really loved Annabella Sciorra, who was also someone who alleged that Weinstein raped her. And he's like, you know, she was on the top of her game in the early 90s, you know, and then she just kind of dropped off. And Rosie Perez also made a statement about it, say that she just kind of, after a point, just really withdrew and disappeared. But he was like, the best thing I could think of to honour her talent and to honour her was to just go back and watch her entire catalogue of films. So I encourage you all to, you know, support these women who have spoken bravely about their abuse and go and watch their back catalogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and think about them as artists and what they've been able to achieve.
Yeah, great idea. I also love her. She's fabulous. Oh,
amazing. Yeah.
And that concludes episode 8 of Club Soderbergh, a show that seemingly may never end. If you haven't caught up on our earlier episodes, there's still time to get up to scratch on the chronological filmography of Steven Soderbergh. Although that's not technically may not be true. Maybe it's too late to catch up with us now. But you can subscribe to us on Beyond Pod, TuneIn, iTunes, and wherever great podcasts are found. Thanks as always to Zeph Anastasio, our sound engineer extraordinaire and gracious host. We'd love to hear from you, hear about your impressions of Soderbergh films or your favourite bits of Soderbergh trivia. You can contact the team at club@clubsoderbergh.com, Facebook page Club Soderbergh, Twitter @ClubSoderbergh, and we'd really love to be engaged with other Soderbergh fans, so please don't be shy. See you in a month for more Soderbergh on the rocks.